Pam Colleen, of course, very well known to Londoners. She's the co-author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Great Bird Flu Hoax, and the author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic, and has opened our eyes to the story behind so many people in the news who go over to the dark side, who go crazy, who lose it, school shooters, and so on. And so just before we get to her, phones are starting to light up on this one. I'd really like to hear your theory on whether this is, in fact, suicide. Is it suicide or is it mass murder? Why don't you just think on that? It's a tough one. It's an absolutely tough one. And we stress again, as one consultant said today, we should keep the powder dry. But Pam Colleen, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
We'll talk to you about your book later on. Absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of questions about the book. But let me just bring up one case that kept coming back in my mind. In South London a few years ago, we had the murder of a young boy by his father. And we have had that father, David Carmichael, in the studio. And he was a prominent Canadian. He was the voice of participation. We would see him on TV. He was interviewed. He's a very bright man and a very likable man. And yet, in his own world of delusion, he thought he was doing the world a favor. And you and I have chatted so many times over the last few years about people who do school shootings. Where is their head at? And I'm not making any suggestion whatsoever about this particular pilot, but I just thought it would be very interesting to ask you, what are the thoughts that are going through your minds about a young 28-year-old man who just dreamed of being a pilot, realized that dream, flew for a subsidiary of Lufthansa, which is about as good as it gets in Germany, seems to be well-adjusted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're seeing this bad mood epidemic. You know, separate from that particular case, we're seeing a lot of irrational behavior in general in society. I mean, earlier today here on the radio, you were talking about this woman who went into a McDonald's to shoot people because she didn't have bacon on her hamburger or something along that line. I mean, we're seeing so much irrational behavior out there today. And one of the things we've discussed with people like David Carmichael is the side effect of psychiatric medications. And so we need to put that into the mix in terms of, you know, questioning why people are going over the edge like this. And where David is concerned, of course, he was using the drug Paxil. And he described in detail the delusional thinking that goes on when he started taking that drug. Now, here's a guy who was very well respected in his community. He was a good father, good husband. And for weeks before this murder, he plotted out the death of his son, and nobody knew it. His wife had no idea that there was anything wrong with him. So his big message to people is that these psychiatric medications can cause, you know, homicidal and suicidal thinking. But, you know, nobody around you could notice this, that you can seem perfectly normal but still plot out this kind of devastating behavior.
Let me ask you the simple question that I asked Richard Plotkar. If you are the pilot of a plane and you drive it into a mountain and you have to strategize to do that by doing something like locking your other pilot out of the cabin, and you have to strategize to make sure the door is locked because that pilot has the code to the door and can unlock it unless you relock it, and you have to make various maneuvers, your mind is working in the sense of being able to fly an aircraft, which is very complex. Mm-hmm. Is that suicide, or is your brain still working enough to know there's 150 people back
there?
Well,
as he said, though, but he said they're not thinking straight. You know, they're making very, very bad, tragic, fatal decisions. They're just not thinking straight, as he said in the interview. They're not thinking normally. And you and I can't understand that thinking. But somebody who maybe has taken those drugs will understand that kind of thinking, because a lot of people might go through that thinking while they're on some of these drugs. And fortunately, nothing bad happens. But I talk to people quite often who are taking psychiatric medications, and they think these very dark thoughts. They don't always act on them, but in some cases, tragically, people might.
Okay, so I'm trying to put those two parts of what you just said together. Is he just thinking about himself, and this pain is so horrible that I want to kill myself, and I want to kill myself right now, so I'm going to drive this plane into the mountain? Or is there a darker side to all of that where I want to do it in spectacular fashion and I want to kill other people as well?
Yeah, I guess we'll find out in time. It would be highly speculative at this stage. I mean, maybe, you know, it was part of his master plan that he wanted to, you know, some of these mass murderers, of course, they just want notoriety. They want to go out and be in the newspapers and have their name splashed all over the papers. Sometimes that's their agenda, and we don't know at this stage. But I can tell you, you know, he clearly was not thinking normally. He was thinking irrationally. And that's sometimes what people, what triggers that type of thinking sometimes is the actual drugs themselves. We've had Dr. David Healy on the show, who wrote the book Farmageddon. And he said in 90% of these school shootings, for example, that these people are on or are coming off of psychiatric medications.
No indication of any of that so far in the case of Mr. Lubitz, Andreas Lubitz. There was a lot of talk today, and of course there have been so many pilots and aviation experts discussing this, and there was an assumption that with its very high standards, Lufthansa would have some pretty rigid psychological exercises you'd have to go through before you were approved as a pilot. There's some other speculation that says, no, they don't have that.
Like I said earlier, you know, David Carmichael warns everybody about his plotting of the death of his son because he, in hindsight, looks back and says, nobody could catch the signs that I was plotting the death of my son.
Even his wife.
His wife had no idea that he was delusional like that. And yet GlaxoSmithKline, and now he's suing GlaxoSmithKline because GlaxoSmithKline, the producer of Paxil, knew that the drug caused this kind of thinking. So, you know, the drug industry knows, the pharmaceutical industry knows that this is a side effect of taking some of their medications. Yet most consumers who are taking these drugs aren't being warned that something like this could happen.
We have to take a short break, folks. I want to ask you the question again. Do you think this was simple suicide, or was this mass murder, or some kind of combination of the two? I'm thinking of various people we've had on this program. I'm thinking, for example, of Penny Knapp, just west of London in the West Lorne area, whose son seemed to have the world by the tail, was a very popular high school student in St. Thomas. Tall and handsome and athletic and smart and loved his mom and on it went to the perfect son, and suddenly he jumps off a bridge onto the 401. Is this something similar, or do you think there is something more sinister here? 643-1290, back with your thoughts in just a moment. Okay, we're getting a flurry of text messages, and we want to thank you for those folks. You can text us at 101290. You can call us at 643-1290, or you can email me at andy@cjbk.com. Still prefer the calls. Love to hear the human voice, and then we can discuss. But let me share some of the text messages, if I could. Andy, I'm sorry. Killing your son is not a side effect of medication. What a crock. Come on. People need to accept responsibility for their actions and stop blaming alcohol and drugs. Pam, I'm just going to let you respond to that particular
comment. Well, David was acquitted for that because they, you know, it's well known that the drug caused the behavior.
The courts agreed.
Yeah, the courts agreed.
Wasn't
so
Pam
Killeen. He's innocent. You know, he's innocent. But this is just not knowing all the facts. And so that's somebody's knee-jerk reaction without knowing the whole story.
Yeah.
People have no idea the devastating side effects of some of these medications.
But
we've done so many shows on this, and people calling in telling us how devastating the side effects are.
There are lots of people, too, who would say, I don't care if he's depressed. I don't care if he broke up with his girlfriend or he was facing bankruptcy. He's a mass murderer, and don't give me the sob story about a suicide and being depressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's hard for healthy people to understand what goes on in the minds of these people when they're, you know, basically not thinking straight, when they're going through the bout of dangerous depression, or if they're dealing with the extra assault of having some of these medications affecting their minds as well.
Okay. I just want to go to CNN, but we'll be doing that from time to time this afternoon as they discuss this case, because the whole world is wrestling with this. Is this a mass murder? Is this a suicide? But let's go to CNN for just a moment.
Military pilot explains to CNN's Kyung Law how that's even possible.
Either pilot, left or right, co-pilot or captain, can touch it. It's in the the normal position is a spring-loaded. If I want to unlock it, I unlock it, and that unlocks the door. They can come in, but it's spring-loaded back to the norm. In the norm position, the door cannot be opened by the regular knob. You have to have either a keypad to open it, or I have to unlock it.
The only way the pilot or the co-pilot cannot get in then in a modern plane with a keypad is by someone purposefully locking them out.
Holding it in the lock position.
So we're going to pick up on that. Let's talk about this. David Soucy, a CNN safety analyst and former FAA safety inspector. Lessa Bind, a CNN aviation analyst and a Boeing 777 captain. So, gentlemen, welcome back. And if I may, let's go to the broader picture. And let me just turn and show you this picture that we have here. This is a picture of the cockpit. This is
anyway, you can see it is being discussed the world over, and especially CNN. And let's go to the phones. Derek, appreciate the call.
Yeah, hi, Andy. I'm just kind of interested in the fact that would this have happened at all if the captain hadn't got up and left the cockpit? Makes you wonder because it doesn't seem to be premeditated. Once the captain left, it all seemed to happen. If he'd have stayed.
You know, Derek, that is an excellent question because I'm thinking they had only, you know, they had been in the air not a great deal of time. And was it just coincidence that the pilot got up to go to the washroom at that time? Did the co-pilot strategize, hey, when he goes to the washroom, that's when I'll lock the door? We just don't know yet, Derek.
No, I mean, how would he know that he'd get up and go over a short journey like that? But it still begs the question, maybe the next flight he was on, or two flights from now, he may have done the same thing. So.
Or maybe the previous three flights he considered it.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. Yeah.
Derek, let me ask you, as you and we stress that we don't have the facts yet. To you, if there are two ends to this spectrum, one is suicide, poor guy, depressed, and clinically depressed, or the other end, no, he had some kind of an agenda, and this is mass murder. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
Based on what I've seen and what I've heard, I think it's a combination of both. I think he, to do something like that, to take his own life in such a way, he cannot be unclear as to how many other people he's responsible for and sitting behind him. So I think it's a combination of both.
Wow. Yeah, it's a tough one. Let me just ask you this before we let you go. Will this make you more nervous about flying?
Always, yeah. It always does. It seems to stick in your memory for maybe 2 or 3 months, and if everything goes quiet, you tend to forget about it again until something else happens.
Right, but this is a different mental process when you think, okay, what are the chances of an engine blowing up or a plane being struck by lightning or those sorts of things? But when the thought is planted in your mind that the safety of your flight depends on the psychological health of those two, or even just one man now in the cockpit, that's scary.
Well, Andy, I think ever since 9/11, I think everyone thinks a little bit different. And any flights that I've been on since that particular date, for some strange reason, when you sit to wait to go on the aircraft, you just scan the room. You take a look around and see who's flying with you. Before that date, I don't think I ever did that.
Yeah, I think the blind trust that we have in pilots has taken a serious hit today.
I'd hate to think that there's a whole string of people like that out there. But, I mean, you know, you've got people on the road. You've got people on buses doing weird things. You just have to take life as it comes, don't you?
There we go. Derek, I appreciate the call. Anyway, Pam, Matt Drake says hello. It's good to hear you on the air. Do you remember Matt Drake from high school?
Oh, Matt.
Yeah. There we go. Just wanted to say hello.
He says, hi, Matt.
He says, call me after the show. We'll talk about Pam in high school. Okay, we'll do that, Matt. Here's another text. Andy, medication cannot drive you to kill. That has to be in you already.
No, the research is showing up more and more and more. It's very clear that it's the trigger is some of the medication in particular individuals, of course. There has to be a perfect storm going on. No, there's clear evidence to show that the trigger is the psychiatric medications.
Well, I always say coffee to me is not a beverage. It's a drug.
It is.
And when I see what, you know, even a medium or even a small coffee can do to my state of mind and energy, I go, whoa. Imagine if I had, what do they call the big one, the big bucket? And that's coffee. That's caffeine.
Mm-hmm. So just look at road rage. I mean, these are rational people probably. You know, if you look at them and you see they're in day-to-day living, you know, and all of a sudden they act out in road rage, totally irrational. You know, it's amazing what can happen when people are going through an adrenaline rush.
Wow. Let's go back to the phones. Ann, thanks for the call.
Oh, hi, Andy. I really enjoy hearing Pam on your program about it. She's entirely right about it. I've suffered from depression for years, and I was on a medication several years ago that my doctor gave me, and I was paranoid and angry, and I couldn't sleep. It was just awful, and I said, I'm not taking this crap. I feel worse, you know, than I did with the depression. It was that awful. And I've confirmed with my own doctor, by the way, everything she's saying. My own doctor says these medications coming from the States in particular, they're not even scientifically tested. It's completely unethical what they're doing. And they're very, very dangerous. And she also said she herself has been looking into it. And Pam's also right. All those shootings in the States, all those young men, like young men that did it, all of them were on those drugs.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and your thoughts about this particular pilot, and we stress again, this is just speculation. Was this suicide or was this mass murder?
I think, like the previous caller said, it's probably a combination of both. But frankly, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that this gentleman was on this type of medication.
So is that where your mind goes when you see these stories in the news? Do you automatically think, side effect of the drugs?
I do, because, I mean, as somebody that suffers from depression myself, I'm not a violent person. I wouldn't have thoughts like that, right? Mm-hmm. There are thousands of people that suffer from depression. But this is such an egregious act. I mean, it is mass murder. It's so...
And let me ask you, how serious was your depression? I wanted to explain in a moment just why I ask you that question. Here's the question I'm getting to. Was the depression, if that's the story on this pilot, it was not so serious that he couldn't still fly the plane. He was very capable of still flying the plane and doing all the mechanical things you need to know and do to fly the plane. So do you see the two channels? Could he be on these two channels? One, I can fly the plane. I'm a very capable pilot. On the other hand, I want to kill myself as fast as I can.
Absolutely. And I mean, during some of the worst of my depression, when I felt like that, like taking my life, most people didn't realize that because it's not like something you're going to say to your friends, oh, by the way, I want to die, right? And I mean, there's a lot of shame involved with it. Obviously, it's not proper thinking. And thank God I found a good doctor and I don't, you know.
About 70% of the people out there with depression are struggling every single day in silence, Andy. They are looking for answers, and they can't find answers. So all they do is basically, you know, fake it till they make it. They crawl to work every single day. They crawl home, and they all they can do at night is maybe watch Survivor on television. There's not much more that they can do in the day.
But wouldn't other people and weren't you the... You
no,
know,
they fake it. They fake it till they make it. They're struggling with brain fog, with depression, with fatigue, with anxiety, with insomnia, and they have to pay the bills and they can't escape it. And then they go to the doctors and the doctors can't help them. They take the medications make them feel worse. And so they just feel like there's no answer. They throw up their arms and they just go through every day with emotions, but they really don't feel great at all.
And let me ask you, did people around you notice?
I think some of my closest, my one best friend probably did, but she has, we both have PTSD. We have different things. So I think she was more in tune to it. And I'm like that with her. I can always tell when she's depressed.
That's very interesting. You should say that. So that leads to my next question. If this co-pilot was so depressed that he was going to take an airplane full of people, 150 people, into a mountain, wouldn't his colleague notice symptoms?
Not necessarily. I guess it depends on how close they were to the man. I mean, as I said, it is hard to detect it. Like Pam's saying, with people, my one friend, we're very, very close, and I can see her husband can tell, right? I remember him calling, and he said, I think she's really depressed, and I said, oh, she is. There's no doubt. We noticed it. Other people may not have, right? Maybe other people would not have noticed. So it's very difficult to say, Andy, but I do question if this man was on this medication because these medications are very dangerous, and I think Big Pharma really needs to be dealt with because from what my own doctor said, and I know Pam would understand this, these studies are actually rigged, Andy, and they have their own peers, or people participating in these manufacturing of the drugs doing these studies. It's a sham, basically.
Okay, we have to leave it there, Ann. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Bob. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, your guest there on the Paxil.
Yes.
The Paxo, this was about 10 years ago, I quit cold turkey drinking and smoking with the help of the doctor because, of course, I couldn't sleep. I was irritable. Obviously, without sleeping, I'm not able to work effectively as well. And he put me on Paxo, and I couldn't even think of becoming depressed.
Say that last sentence again.
I couldn't even begin to think of anything sad or becoming depressed. It was a total antidepressant.
Right. And then how long were you on the Paxil?
Until I broke out, and I had to come off of it when I broke out and a skin rash.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor put me on another medication, and then until finally he got something that would work. But and then another friend of mine who did the same, a lot younger friend of mine, went on Paxil, and he was a totally different person altogether. He went up and down his boss. He was irritable. He was thinking about suicide. It was making him feel like he was suicidal and everything. So these drugs are definitely very scary.
Okay, so when you hear, Bob, about this pilot who supposedly was so depressed that he was going to kill himself and take 150 people with him, you think he could fly the plane and do all the mechanical things and act in such a manner that his colleague pilot was not suspicious? He could play the two channels at the same time. I'm fine, I'm normal, now I'm going to kill myself.
He could play it right to the hilt.
Hmm.
That is so
scary. Just
it's
like
very,
David.
Very scary indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bob, I'm wondering, you know, we're in the very early stages of this investigation, but I can't imagine anyone getting on an airplane anywhere in the world the next 2 or 3 days without kind of peeking over the seat to see if they can see the pilot to see what kind of state of mind they're in or what mood they're in.
Well, you'd never know because look at the photograph of the individual himself, Andre. He was sitting, the San Francisco Bridge?
Yes.
You can't tell by looking at him how happy or how sad really that man would be.
Okay, so you've obviously been watching CNN or some of the news coverage. What's your theory on what happened here?
No, I think it was a drug-induced. It was a mass murder myself. I really don't think it was just a true suicide. I think it was a combination of drugs. And with the drugs, of course, made this individual a person that, he became a monster.
Okay, terrific. Very, very interesting
very
news.
Very interesting, yes.
I just want to share this. My producer, Al Coombs, has just brought this to my attention. We've seen 2 or 3 airlines. I know KLM in Holland, for one, has this policy. They always have to have 2 people in the cockpit. And now I'm seeing the breaking news that Air Canada has already decided to require 2 people in the cockpit after these revelations about the Germanwings co-pilot. So, Pam, you're already seeing an airline saying, we didn't have it all figured out before. We haven't been had all the protocol in place. And, of course, after something like this, you have to review your procedures. But to have a decision this quickly from Air Canada is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're seeing so much instability in society today in general. And I just thought of the movie with Denzel Washington, you know, when he was the airline pilot who rescued the plane, so to speak.
Yes.
And he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And there you have this. It was a really terrifying scenario with this guy who's, you know, high on cocaine and drinking alcohol on top of that. And he's manning a plane with, you know, a couple hundred passengers in it.
Scary stuff. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about Pam Colleen's new book. Oh, my. This is interesting. Sex. It seems like everybody is having explosive sex. I love the quote in the book from Mae West. We've all heard it before. A hard man is good to find. Naughty, naughty. Pam isn't above getting naughty in the book. But she's not above getting real candid about what's happening to our sex lives in the world. We've gotten used to a world run by Viagra. Is that normal? Is that the way it was intended? What's going on? What percentage of people are even satisfied sexually? And not just those over 65. It's a new book. We'll talk about it in just a moment right here on The Live Drive with Andy Udman on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
This is The Live Drive with Andy Udman. Call now, 519-643-1290. News Talk 1290 CJBK.
351, okay. We're just going to park the world discussion about the plane crash for just a few moments because Pam Colleen has a new book out. And there was a reason Mae West said a hard man is good to find. And sorry about the naughty expression, but it leads into what Pam has discussed on this radio program for years, and that is, well, to be blunt, Pam, when it comes to sex, we're getting pretty screwed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing epidemics of problems with low libido, infertility, erectile dysfunction, PMS, hot flashes in women. And unfortunately, what we're doing today as a society is we're actually normalizing these symptoms when they really aren't normal.
Let's look at the facts. What percent of women, for example, men, sexual dysfunction? I mean, you've got in the intro to the book, warning signs. In a survey conducted among a large U.S. sample, the prevalence of sexual dysfunction for women, 43%, almost half?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a devastating problem, and it's ruining relationships, the possibility of relationships and ruining the possibility of maintaining relationships.
For men, 31%. So this is not just people over 50. This is overall 31%. Erectile dysfunction. Oh, my goodness. You can't turn on a TV for more than 5 minutes without hearing that phrase. Increases as men age. 52% of men ages 40 to 70 have some degree of impotence, half. Erectile dysfunction now becoming more common in younger men, and on it goes. The sexual complaint most commonly heard by health professionals regarding the lack of sexual desire or sexual disinterest, and only 29%, less than a third of women, report being able to achieve orgasm during sex. Those are frightening numbers.
Oh, I know. And so I'm talking, the book is about the decline of human sexuality. And it's basically saying, you know, wisdom, the subtitle of my book is How Wisdom Will Save Humans from Falling into Extinction. Given all of this sexual dysfunction, how on earth are humans going to be able to create offspring? I mean, this is a huge concern.
Literally threatens the future of
humanity
as we know it.
No question, but it's interfering with people's quality of lives. People are scratching their heads. They're not happy, and they're not fulfilled sexually. And I'm saying to people that the answers are not what we've been looking for. You know, people are looking for snake oils and potions and, you know, all this hocus pocus, and it doesn't seem to be working, because otherwise, why are we still scrambling around looking for answers, right? So what we've been doing is we haven't been looking at the nutritional base that is necessary in order to create healthy hormonal function.
Back to some of the text messages, Andy. It's all the hormones and foods and plastics screwing up the males. Hey, Andy, is ISIS responsible for the six beheaded coyotes in London? So some people are very cynical. But back to the topic of sex, Pam. This is not just a titillating book. This is saying, folks, this is really, really serious stuff. And if I just got last night an email from some friends who we had told were unable to conceive children, because that's the one topic we haven't touched on in all of this, is just the inability to have children.
Yeah, infertility is a huge problem today. And couples are going through all sorts of infertility treatments that have side effects. They're very uncomfortable, very costly. And what I talk about in the book is I talk about the work of Dr. Weston A. Price and how he traveled and studied primitive cultures. And he didn't see these problems in primitive cultures as long as they maintained their ancestral diets. And one of the reasons why we're seeing so much infertility today is not just because of the chemicals in the environment, it's because we're not eating enough animal fat in the diet. And in primitive cultures, they always had special foods, sacred foods, reserved for parents to be. So in some cultures, you know, it might have been caviar, you know, fish eggs. It might have been bear fat, for example. Here in North America, the natives would use bear fat to increase fertility in couples. So if a couple was having trouble conceiving a child, they would just go on a diet high in bear fat, and within a couple months they would conceive a child. So one of the things that's missing from the equation is making sure that women are getting enough animal fat in the diet. And of course, because of this animal fat phobia that we've been subjected to now for several decades, this is one of the reasons why we're seeing problems with fertility and so many other hormonally related problems.
Pam, this is such a painful subject. I want to have the opportunity for our listeners to ask you about that, because there are people you know are listening right now who are unable to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's devastating for them. And this is a book they need to read and at least consider. Do you have a few moments you could stay on the other side of the news? I know you have an appointment in the next hour.
But right. I have some time. Sure.
Okay, terrific. So we'll keep Pam on just about this whole painful question of sexual dysfunction and infertility. It's a painful subject. It's a difficult subject, It's a subject we need to talk about. And I want to give you the opportunity to call Pam and talk to her yourself, because I know in our listeners right now, this is an issue for a lot of people. So let's talk about that when we come back on the other side of CTV News. 6 minutes now after 4 o'clock, folks, we're having a very candid adult conversation. So you may want to take that into consideration if you have tender ears. We're talking about Pam Colleen's new book, Survival of the Unfittest, How Wisdom Will Save Humans from Falling into Extinction. Basically, she's saying in a nutshell, our sex lives are horribly screwed up, that 43% of women in a recent survey showed sexual dysfunction. For men, it was about a third, 31%. We're already starting to get text messages. Andy, I had prostate cancer. Doctor removed nerve endings. I have no sexual functions down below, so I rely on the blue pill. Andy, what about over-sexualization and men just trying to get fulfilled through porn. Pam, again, for those listeners who have just joined us, what prompted you to tackle this particular
subject? I just don't see how our children are going to be able to have children. They're so incredibly sick. You know, over 25% of them have already some kind of mental disorder. You know, it's one quarter of our children are already compromised. If they're already compromised as children, then that doesn't bode well for their futures.
That was in a London Free Press story a couple of years ago, and I'm thinking 27%. It was
28%. It was the survey done by the teachers, basically saying that they think that about 28% of the kids have some kind of mental disorder today. And now, when I was a kid, when you were a kid, I remember kids being pretty normal. I don't remember seeing this kind of instability among my peers in grade school or high school, for that matter. So we have a very unstable youth population. And also in the book, I talk about, you just talk to people, random people. And the more I talk to people, the more I realize that, you know, these kids are not really ready for the workforce either. They're too exhausted for the workforce. So in the book, I talk about just talking to a couple of sales ladies, and they told me they couldn't hire young girls across the street from their high school to come in and work in sales in a clothing store because they're so unreliable. They don't show up for work, and then they come into work and they're always late, and this weekend I can't come into work because I got to go to Grand Bend to go to a party. The other day I was talking to a store owner, and he said to me, these kids I'm hiring today can't even do math. They can't do simple math. And so
what does that have to do with sex, the main focus of this book?
Well, if they can't carry a job, if they're not strong enough to carry a job, then how are they going to be able to have a stable relationship, get married, support their children if they have children? What does this mean in terms of the stability of their future lives? And it does it to me. It just it all smells bad news, you know. When I was in high school and we had a part-time job, anybody who had a part-time job, it was a badge of honor. You showed up early, you even stayed late. You know, nobody complained about having a part-time job. Now these kids are so incredibly exhausted or self-entitled or whatever it is that they're going through.
So that's the question. Is it because we think kids today are spoiled, they're so entitled, and you're saying, wait a minute, yeah, that's all true, but there's a reason.
Yeah, I think a lot of these kids have chronic fatigue and don't know it. I think these kids were born sick. And so they don't remember having energy. When I collapsed with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, I had a period of my life where I remember what energy felt like. I remember what it felt like to have a clear brain, not the brain fog and so on, which so many people have today. And so that's why I fought so hard and so long to get my health back. But unfortunately, kids today are born sick. They're born with chronic fatigue. They're born with brain fog. They're born with depression and irritability and lethargy and apathy. So they don't know what true health feels like. So they have no real incentive to try and be healthy. And they can all look fine on the outside, but on the inside, they're really, really struggling. And then sometimes you can see it in terms of the outcomes at school or whether or not they have enough energy to even look for a job.
Big Pharma loves it. I mean, you can't watch ABC News without seeing Viagra and all the other products designed to address specifically this problem.
Yeah, well, they get them on Ritalin or Prozac at very young ages. And then, okay, what does that mean in terms of their 20s and their 30s? What kind of drugs are they going to need down the road?
Okay, specifically on the problem of infertility, because it's such a painful one, and I've known so many couples who have this problem, and the wonderful news they shared last night was that they are now pregnant, but it took 2 years of treatment through an infertility.
Yeah, but they never heard about animal fat being crucial for fertility. You know, they're not being told that.
Hold that thought. If you have questions for Pam, I want to talk about this painful subject, infertility in particular, and what your theory is on why we're seeing so much of it. Back with that in just a moment right here on the Live Drive with Andy Edmond on News Talk 1290 CJBK. 14 minutes now after 4 o'clock. Pam Killeen out with a new book about sex and how messed up we are in the world sexually and how serious that is, especially the problem of infertility and sexual dysfunction leading to marriage breakups and so much more. Let's go to the phones and get your reaction to what you're hearing, Alan.
With all due respect, I mean, I just what I'm hearing here is not passing my smell test. I mean, do you have any science to actually back up your observation that the lack of animal fat consumption is directly correlated to this problem?
Oh, absolutely. I have all sorts of information in my book.
There's no question about it, because in the animal fat, of course, you have cholesterol. And cholesterol is the precursor to making hormones like estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. So, yes, there's absolutely a lot of scientific literature to back this up. No question about it.
And they're credible in a medical journal, or are these just limited studies?
It's very credible. Very, very credible. This is also...
I guess what I'm saying is there's a large population that does have animal fat in their diet, and they're still having problems with reproduction. So I fear that you're kind of...
No. With what is happening, of course, is we have the perfect storm. So the low-fat diet is one of the big variables that is compromising human sexuality in general. And on top of that, you have the xenoestrogens, the synthetic estrogens coming from industry, for example. So we estrogen. We have very toxic forms of estrogen that our bodies are absorbing, which is only amplifying this problem, all right? Because what we're doing is we're throwing off the very delicate balance of estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. So we have that, and on top of that, in terms of the destruction of human sexuality, I can't ignore the problems with, for example, online pornography. So we have all sorts of things coming at us that are really destroying what I would consider to be healthy human sexuality, and animal fat is a big, big part of the issue.
Alan, let me just ask you to back up the train a little bit. Do you agree about her perspective on the epidemic proportions for sexual dysfunction?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert at this, so I mean, I don't know if the percentage of population has increased, but I mean, it certainly sounds it from, but at the same time, it was a hush-hush topic long ago that people didn't want to actually admit that they were having these problems. So, you know, is it a matter of more people are coming forward and saying that I have these issues, or is it that we genuinely have more people who are experiencing these problems?
But how many?
I appreciate you taking my answer or my question.
How many minutes of watching ABC or NBC or CBS in the evening can you watch without hearing the phrase erectile dysfunction?
No, I agree with that. But in the 50s, you'd never would have had that on the news because no one would admit it. Do you know what I mean? So a part of it is that the social stigma of having a reproductive issue is less now than it was back when. So
there's so many things that have changed, because just as you're talking, I'm thinking back to my earlier years. And it was, I mean, I'm from a family of seven, and we were considered by some standards small. I mean, it was very common to have families of 10 kids and 12 kids and so on. And of course, then there's a whole issue of birth control came into it. I understand that. But
that's also a social choice, right? That people chose to have larger families. That's not necessarily because your parents were that much more fertile than today's parents.
No, I'm just saying, that's what I'm saying. So many things have changed that it's hard to weed out one particular factor. But when you see how much of the drug industry today is focused on this area of sexual dysfunction, you see what a huge, huge issue it is.
Right. No, absolutely. I agree with that.
Okay,
for sure.
Alan, terrific. Okay, we have just a couple moments left before you have to go. Pam, you have a book launch.
A book launch, yeah. Cherry Hill Mall Library on Tuesday night at 6:30. So it's, I'm excited. The book is out. It's on Amazon as well. So it's available as an ebook or paperback. But if people want to come out, I'll be doing a short presentation on some of the key points in the book on Tuesday night at the Cherry Hill Mall Library.
Okay, terrific. And just for those who have just joined us, for whom do you think the book is of particular interest?
I think it's for everybody. I think if we want to see our children grow up to be happy, healthy, productive adults, you know, happily married with kids or single with kids. It doesn't matter if they're married or not, but, you know, we want to see them have happy futures. And I wrote this book as a call to action because I'm trying to deal with this as a preventative thing. I think that too many people are settling for feeling lousy, for having terrible sex lives. And I think something more can be done to improve the happiness and healthfulness of adults today, but also to do this as a way to prevent devastation, tragedy happening from our children today.
The author is Pam Colleen, right here in London, Ontario. The book is Survival of the Unfittest, How Wisdom Will Save Humans from Falling into Extinction. As I said to her, I would have called it How Screwed Up Our Sex Lives Are and How we Better Fix It Fast. Before we end civilization. Pam, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.